Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Augustine Burroughs is the author of the autobiographical works Running with Scissors, Dry, Magical Thinking, Possible Side Effects, and A Wolf at the Table, all of which were New York Times bestsellers. His latest is called Lust and Wonder. In it, he chronicles the development and demise of the different relationships he's had while living in New York. He examines what it means to be in love, what it means to be in lust, and what it means to be figuring it all out. Again, the name of the new book is Lust and Wonder, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Augustine Burroughs back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So at what point did you say, oh, I want to write about love and lust?
Well, it wasn't quite like that. I was working on a novel, and I wasn't happy with the direction it was going in, so I started a different novel, and I didn't love that either. And it's really because I had this story woven into the sort of fabric of my life that I needed to write about. And that story was that I'd been sober since 1999. I guess I kind of thought that my life would be, well, not perfect, but certainly I'd make better choices and it would be easier and better and, you know, the promises would be fulfilled. And yet here I was. In many ways, my life was even more of a mess than it ever had been when I was a drunk and I was, you know, I'd made all these terrible choices. I really wanted to look at that. And I was stunned by a very long, almost 10-year relationship that I had been in that was a study of compromise. Those are some of the elements that got me really interested in writing this.
When you look at those elements, it is the fact that, as you just mentioned, you think once you get this aspect of your life that everything else will fall into place. How soon did you realize that, okay, things weren't quite falling into place? And also, are you able to extricate from that what is a result of the previous behavior?
You know, I had been sober for 9 months when I got into a relationship with someone named Dennis, who features in the book. And I had just gotten a book deal. I had just got this literary agent, you know, who sold my first book, a novel. And I felt like I've been sober for 9 months and I'm ready now for a relationship, the one that will last the rest of my life. And I met someone who was, we were very different, you know, very, very different. And, you know, when I look back on it, I think I was really ambitious and I was determined to sort of shapeshift. I found someone I felt was normal and didn't have all the sort of problems, the baggage that I'd had. I mean, I grew up in my mentally ill mother and my alcoholic father. I grew up with their lunatic psychiatrist. And I wrote about that in Running with Scissors. So I didn't trust my instincts, I think, after my childhood. So I sought someone who was sort of the opposite of me, very stable, very even keeled. And, you know, I kind of sold myself to him, I think, because I thought I can be the person that, you know, he wants me to be. I can be this terrific, normal, sane, healthy person. And that's what I wanted to be. But I think that I was actually a very different person. I had, you know, a lot more innate intensity. I didn't want to go, you know, jet skiing. I really wanted to stay home and write. And it all happened, you know, right at the sort of apex of my very, very early sobriety, mm-hmm. you know, publishing and a new relationship and a new agent and a new life, you know. I mean, I'd been drinking for, you know, since I was a teenager. I just couldn't trust my own judgment. I felt like I couldn't trust my own choices. So I sort of found someone who seemed really normal and I kind of wanted him to make decisions.
And we should also note that with all of those things that you just mentioned, also success.
Right. And, you know, the first book sold, you know, 5 copies, but that was fine because it was a published book and I was amazed. It was really my next book that sold. And it was Running with Scissors, which was the memoir. And
the first was the novel, right?
The first was the novel, Television, and then was Running with Scissors. And, you know, the publisher had low expectations for it because it's a book about a kid, a child in real peril, you know, a child who's 12 and given away by his parents to a lunatic psychiatrist who's then molested by a long-term psychiatric patient and doesn't go to school and doesn't, you know, sort of have any friends in the normal world. And it was like growing up almost like being in a cult. As much as my publisher really loved the book and the people within the publishing house loved it and they had a lot of good feedback from booksellers, the expectations were very low. And of course, my expectations were blessedly low because I had been through, you know, the process of publication now with my first book. And, you know, it was never about being a big bestseller for me. It was about having the artifact that I could hold in my hands. It was about the privilege of being able to write, really.
I sold 5 last time. If I sell 10 this time,
oh,
great.
If I sell 5 this time, really, honestly, you know, I mean, it's fine. And it was a huge, huge bestseller right out of the gate. My relationship at that point, there was already trouble. I think I knew early on in that relationship that we were making too many compromises. You know, we were physically, sexually incompatible. Our temperaments were very different. I'm the sort of person that if there's an issue, I want to get it out. I want to figure it out now. I don't want to go to bed with this, you know. Right. I want to talk it through. And he was much more of just, I don't want to have a confrontation. I don't want to rock the boat, you know. And I just didn't listen to that sort of, you know, knock, 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 knock inside my chest that was telling me this might not be really the best thing here. You know, you two might not actually be getting along the way that, you know, you should.
So you were compromising, if you will, for 10 years.
Yes.
But so was he then.
Yeah, right. And, you know, and one of the things that I've heard, and I think probably a lot of your listeners have heard in the media or seen on TV or read, is that relationships are about compromise. And I think because I felt so desperately ill-equipped for life in the big, bad, normal world that I really took that to heart. And I think, you know, I guess this is what it feels like to be in a relationship, this compromise. I guess this kind of compromise is normal. You know, and look, my other relationships were disastrous. They hadn't worked out at all. So obviously, I can't trust my own instincts. And I just have to sort of go with, you know, what seems, at least on the surface, to be more reasonable. I mean, more, and I'm sober. So therefore, this must be a better choice because it's a sober choice. I was very guarded, you know, it was a very polite relationship in a lot of ways, but I was also very guarded. And yet the one person where I was utterly myself without sort of any spit shine was with my agent. And he became more than my agent. He became, you know, my best friend. He read everything I wrote. And I've been writing since I was 8. You know, it's sort of how I process. It's just who I am. Even if I didn't publish another book for the rest of my life, I would still write every day. So my whole life is poured onto the page. The difference was now that I was showing these pages to this guy. You know, when I was around him, I was funny and I felt alive when I was in his presence. I would make up excuses to go stop by the office. You know, I had some freelance advertising work here and I thought we could grab some lunch. And I was always in his office, you know, I mean, as a client and just thinking, I guess if I were really, really annoying, he would tell me. So I must not be annoying, which is actually what, you know, everyone who's completely insufferable probably tells themselves. Yet my sort of relationship, my primary relationship, my romantic relationship, didn't have that spontaneity. It didn't have that easy back and forth, you know, sort of effortless communication and friendship and fun, you know, and that was not there. And as the success of Running with Scissors got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then, you know, more books came out and they were also huge, it was really easy to take the focus away from my relationship and place it on career, on traveling, on, you know, giving book tours and interviews, so that my relationship, it almost became, I don't want to say a routine, but it, in a way it became like a play. It was virtually sexless, so it felt very professional, mm-hmm. very polite. And we had structure. We had 2 dogs. You know, we built a house in Massachusetts, and we were picking out, you know, molding and doorknobs and things. And it was just, and these were all things, of course, that I thought, well, this is what people do. I began to feel that, you know, I'm older now. I'm in my 30s, you know. So I guess passion is something that does fade as you get older. And, you know, you shouldn't mm-hmm. expect, one shouldn't expect to feel the passions, the physical passions and the intellectual passions that one felt in their teens and 20s. So I think I attributed a lot of the sort of dulling down that I was feeling emotionally to age, to just the process of getting older. And again, you know, combined with what compromise, which is what I heard, you know, was what a normal relationship was supposed to be about.
Were you faithful?
Yes.
And we assume he was as well.
Right.
then you're trying to preserve something in that.
Mm-hmm.
You're honoring that commitment.
Exactly. The price, I think, of honoring that commitment seemed like sexuality. And that was one of the things I told myself as well, is that, well, a relationship is about more than just sex. It's to sort of minimize the importance of sex in a relationship. So I would find any sort of self-help book or article that I came across, I would devour if the subject was, why sex isn't the most important thing in a marriage or in a relationship? You know, why sex is not the only form of intimacy? Because, I mean, this made me feel better about being in a relationship that was not really very physical at all. And one where, in fact, I didn't enjoy it when it was physical. It was a very confusing time. You know, I went to a therapist, a sex therapist, to see, like, why is it that I don't feel this kind of connection with this person I'm allegedly with or allegedly supposed to be in love with? And, you know, it came back to probably sex being molested as a child, you know, which is sort of, I kind of thought that would be where it would end up in therapy, but it also didn't feel like the right answer to me. But it was difficult to argue with that. Because, well, it does seem like here I am, you know, in my 30s and really struggling in this sexual relationship. And I was molested as a kid. It's pretty simple to do that math, even though just deep inside it just didn't feel, I didn't hear that sort of bell of truth ringing in my chest. It didn't seem like that was what was going on.
Augustine Burroughs is our guest. The name of the new book is Lust and Wonder, a Memoir. Did you go to therapy together?
In the beginning, I went to therapy alone. We had different therapists.
Mm-hmm.
We did at the very, very end, but in once. But no, I was going alone, and I was, you know, sort of rehashing a lot of stuff that I had thought a lot about over the years and had, in fact, written about and felt like I had, I mean, for lack of a better word, processed. I didn't feel the strings of the past operating me. It just didn't feel like it. But I could not tell you what it was. I couldn't tell you why I had this absence of attraction and desire. I would look inward, look at myself, and here I am writing all these memoirs, you know, at the time. And yet when I looked at myself, when I looked to find the answer to that question, I just drew a blank. I mean, it was like, I didn't have any idea. I don't know. There was nothing there which told me, I've got to know. I know I've got to know, but won't let myself know. It was like, you know, when I was an alcoholic, really, at my absolute worst, I would have a blackout. And this lack of self-knowledge reminded me of a blackout. The powerful lack of an answer when I looked inside. I don't know why. I don't know why I don't want to have sex. I don't know why I'm not engaged physically. I don't know. Not a clue. Mm. That told me, yeah, you do. You do know why. You do.
Did he want to know why you weren't engaged?
All the time. I mean, it was a constant sort of discussion, if not daily, every other day. And that made it worse. I mean, it's a horrible thing, I imagine, to be with someone who is so, you know, physically, sexually withholding. I mean, I'm sure it was terrible for him. That added that sort of pressure to get fixed and to get fixed quickly. It added the sensation of having a gigantic stopwatch over my head 24 hours a day, just tick, tick, tick. It was like living below a bomb, which made it even more, you know, it made me even more inhibited and it made me even more removed, you know, from this. So I would, you know, focus on what was funny in my life, in my writing. I focused on the good, on the dogs and on the comedy.
At what point in the timeline did the lust start?
Well, the lust actually started before I met Dennis. And the lust started on the day that I met my literary agent, Christopher. I had sent my manuscript out to every agent and got tons of rejection slips back, you know. Everyone, no one was interested. I got only rejection back except one agent. And this one agent liked the idea and suggested we meet for lunch. And as I saw him walking toward me on Gansevoort Street, I just silently chanted in my head, you will either be my agent or my boyfriend. I can see that lunch as clearly as if it had just happened, the way he was dipping his French fries into the mustard and the mustard plopping on his shirt and his just like, oh, I'm such a pig, and the way he laughed so easily. Christopher was very, my first impression of him was that he was very comfortable in the world. He reminded me kind of like of a California surfer dude, you know, who just was like, hey, it's okay. Don't worry about it. You know, we're not going to get bit by sharks, dude. Don't worry about it. It's a big ocean. Easygoing, not a catastrophist, kind of, you know, funny and really funny. And his natural reaction was to laugh. And I had the biggest crush on him. But he did become my agent. So immediately I was like, okay, well, that crush has to go away. He's my agent now. So we became agent and client and then friends. And it was, you know, 9 months later, of course, that I met Dennis. So I was really determined not to make a mess of this. I wanted so much to be an author. And here I was, an author. I was not going to screw this up by making a sloppy, disgusting pass at my agent and, you know, getting fired as a client. Plus, he was so professional. He didn't seem like at all that he was interested in me. And I also thought, like, he's totally out of my league anyway. You know, like, he wouldn't even want someone like me. So what am I even, you know, why am I even? I just felt like that's crazy. I actually felt, too, that, like, my attraction to my agent, because he's my agent, obviously, there's a boundary issue there. Obviously, that's a mentally ill attraction. Obviously, that's left over from alcoholism. So look at me. Look what I do. I'm attracted to my agent, the one person I can't have. That's how screwed up I am.
So at what point then, because you talked earlier about in the relationship with Dennis of going through the relationship books and columns and trying to figure out, you know, what could be the case here. So any of those columns, any of those relationship experts would say exactly what you're saying, regardless of your past with alcohol. Yeah, don't sleep with the agent.
Right. Yeah.
So that's sound advice.
Right.
So at what point then did your heart ultimately take over?
Well, my friendship with Christopher just became stronger and stronger and stronger. And he was the first person I wanted to call when anything happened, good or bad. There came a point, I mean, Dennis and I were together almost 10 years. I would ask him frequently, are you okay with us? Are you happy? And he would sort of say, yeah, yep, I'm okay, yep. And I would say, would you tell me if you weren't? Yep, I would tell you. But there came a point when he actually did put into writing all the things he was unhappy with about me. And it was a long list of a sort of catalog of my flaws, including the fact that I drank, you know, the sugar-free ginger ale. But it was one that he'd been keeping for a long time. He'd, in fact, been sort of mentally keeping this very long list of things about me that he couldn't stand. And when I saw it, it was like looking at the blueprints of my life. And that's when it really hit home. Wow, this is not, you don't get over this. This is like, you can't even stand me. You are with me out of some sense of duty. You know, I think he probably felt bad. I'm guessing, but I think he probably felt bad about all the things that had happened to me and probably didn't want to become another bad thing that happened to me. That coincided with me having this little crack in my head where I could imagine for the first time leaving this relationship, even though it would blow my life to smithereens. I could imagine it, and I thought, I would want to find someone like Christopher. And then I thought, there's absolutely nobody like Christopher. And then I kind of realized, wow, it really didn't work. This not trying to fall in love with your agent thing did not work at all because it just, everything fell into place. Oh, that's maybe why I haven't wanted to have sex with this person, because I'm actually in love with someone else who's not only my best friend, but my agent, and who has no idea, and I'm insane. That's what it felt like.
So once you come to that realization, is it slow to morph into the relationship with Christopher, or was it just...
No. It was a freight train that just plowed through the... over the bridge. No, it was not. Then, I mean, everything kind of happened all at once in a big disastrous explosion of life. It was awful and it was wonderful at the same time. It was hurtful and painful and ugly and messy and magnificent. That is something that I think, as someone who was an alcoholic for so many years, I have grown accustomed to, the fact that different feelings can coexist at the very same time. You know, it's like, it's stunning. I mean, it's really stunning how you can feel such contradictory emotions right there. It's like you're sitting on a bench and here is tremendous happiness on your right and here is great loss and grief on your left, you know, and there you are. So it was messy. But it was also very, I didn't know. You know, I mean, I had to tell him. I had to tell Christopher what I felt. I couldn't just, of course, at this point, it was like, I felt absolutely mad. And I no longer cared about being mentally healthy. And I didn't care if it was a bad choice. And I didn't care if it was absolutely crazy. All I knew is every molecule in my body is banging pot lids together inside my chest. That's what it felt like. It was just, so I have to do this. So I told him. He was like, snap out of it. It's a crush. You know, I was like, I don't think after 10 years it's a crush.
But it was reciprocated.
It was reciprocated. It was reciprocated. And it was amazing. And it still is. It's amazing. I'm amazed by it. I'm always in a state of constant lust and wonder. I really am. I am stunned by this turn of events in my life.
When we have authors read, they always read from the beginning of the book. But I'm hoping you'll read the end of the book, because it really is a beautiful examination of what you were just describing.
Sure, I'd love to. We were walking along the Battery Park City Esplanade beside the riverfront, and the dogs were straining against their leashes. There were so many stars, which you just don't expect ever to see in Manhattan. I said to Christopher, do you realize that when you look at something through an electron microscope and then you look out into the distant galaxy through a telescope, it looks the same? You can't even tell if you're looking at something tiny or something huge. He nodded like, yeah, that's nice. I smirked. You don't give a crap about that stuff, do you? I said. He laughed. No, not really. The dogs paused to sniff the fascinating roots of the same tree. I said, okay. In that case, what was A Flock of Seagulls' biggest hit? Christopher beamed at me as the wind blew into our faces from the river. His eyes glittered, and he replied without pausing to think about it, faster than Google, as though he'd been expecting this question all his life. I ran. I placed my hand against the side of his precious electric face and felt the stubble beneath my fingers. I was overwhelmed with the lust and wonder of it all.
Augustine Burroughs reading from Lust and Wonder, a memoir. And again, not to give away the ending, but you're married?
Yes.
You're happy?
Yes.
And now you just wait for the next catastrophe and write about it.
I do. I actually do wait for the next catastrophe. That part of my personality seems to be permanent, like eye color. But I have to say, you know, at least I don't think I take it as seriously, because Christopher is the opposite of a catastrophist. He really is. So it's really helpful to be around someone who is like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
But he's your agent, too, so he also wants the catastrophe, right?
No, I think he doesn't.
Okay, all right. He can separate that.
Yeah, he's got much bigger and better clients than me.
The name of the new book is Lust and Wonder, a memoir. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Augustine Burroughs, a great thrill to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Again, the name of the book is Lust and Wonder. It is published by St. Martin's Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows, and you can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.